For at least 3 days, BlackBerry smartphone users around the world couldn't do much with their thumbs. A technical glitch shut down service and affected millions of BlackBerry users. The problem has been fixed, but it is very bad news for the Canadian company that makes the devices. Earlier today, Mike Lazaridis, the founder of the company, said in an online video that his goal has always been reliability.
We did not deliver on that goal this week, not even close. I apologize for the service outages this week. We've let many of you down.
So will BlackBerry users accept that apology, or will this latest glitch sink the company? Chip Cummins from the Wall Street Journal joins us now. Welcome.
Hi.
Chip, the company that makes BlackBerry's, Research in Motion, has already seen its stock price drop 60% this year as more and more people are buying iPhones and Androids. Will we look back on this latest trouble and say this was the death knell?
Well, it certainly came at the worst time possible for the company. You have a company that is fighting to stem a very rapid drop in market share in North America. That said, BlackBerry has a very loyal following among corporate clients. And while it's very easy for someone like you or me to go and say, I'm not going to use a BlackBerry anymore, I'm going to go use an iPhone or one of the phones powered by Android, it's very, very difficult for a company with thousands of employees to do that.
Chip, explain how this service outage actually happened.
The company has given few specific details, but what we do know is RIM has a fairly unique network which it builds and maintains itself. That's seen as more secure, but when problems happen, there's not a lot of redundancy. What happened this time, we're told by RIM, is a switch at one of its control centers in England failed. A backup system failed, and that shut down service for a large swath of the world. Now, in an attempt to fix that, the company throttled back service in the rest of the world, and the delays that stacked up in sending data out brought down service across the world.
Let me ask you about the devices, because BlackBerry's market share has been tanking for the past 3 years from something like half of all mobile devices around the world just 3 years ago, now to, I understand, about 12%.
That's right.
Is the problem the devices, that they simply can't offer what Androids or iPhones can offer?
BlackBerry had a very difficult time realizing that there was a major shift in the market away from the corporate customer and towards the consumer market. Now, a lot of people worry that they're too far behind to catch up. They've promised a number of new products. They've launched a number of new BlackBerry phones, which we understand are selling pretty well. Increasingly, however, people wonder whether that's enough.
Chip, what do you think it will take for Research in Motion to fully recover from this?
Well, I think a lot is riding on their new phones due out next year. If those phones have a significant wow factor, if they work and work well, then I can see RIM clawing back some of its market share. The big risk, of course, is that they don't do that and they become a niche player.
Chip Cummins, thanks.
Thank you.
That's Chip Cummins. He covers Canada for the Wall Street Journal. He was speaking about the future of Research in Motion. That's the Canadian company that makes BlackBerries.
Apple's new iPhone 4S will be in stores tomorrow. The company says that consumers pre-ordered over 1 million phones in less than 24 hours when they went on sale online last Friday. Only this week, though, have technology writers had a chance to put the new iPhone through its paces. One of them is Rich Jaroslawski of Bloomberg. He joins us from Stanford, California, to tell us how the 4S stacks up against the competition. And he says it doesn't look all that new, at least on the outside.
Physically, it's identical to the previous iPhone 4. It's kind of like a car where the exterior styling hasn't been changed, but under the hood, they've popped in a new engine. They've added a whole lot of new features and things, and you can't really tell the difference until you take it out for a spin.
And the most spectacular, perhaps, of these new features might be this voice instruction software. What is it exactly?
Well, it's a feature called Siri, and it is a voice recognition and response system. They call it a personal assistant. You ask it things, it tells you, or it finds stuff for you. You can ask it You know, where's a good sushi restaurant around here? It knows where you are, and it returns a list of restaurants. You can ask it to schedule a calendar item for yourself or set a reminder. If you're driving, you can dictate a text message and have it sent without taking your hands off the wheel.
Okay. What are some of the questions you've been asking it?
Well, let's see if it'll answer something for us right now. Siri, what's the best smartphone?
I think you've already answered that question.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Have you stumped it?
I have stumped it. I've a couple times it sort of misunderstood me. Sometimes it'll just come back and say, "I don't understand you, Rich." It does call me by name, which is a little unnerving. Sometimes it will take what I tell it, and it doesn't have an answer itself, but it'll offer to do a web search for me.
What are a couple of the other features here that make this distinctive, if anything?
Well, a couple of things that I was very struck by besides Siri are, number one, it is very fast, particularly on the AT&T network. Now, the phone is available also on Verizon and, for the first time, Sprint. The other thing that's different about it is that they've done a lot of work on the camera. They've improved the optics. They've improved the software. And it's now at a point where the camera is roughly comparable to a low-end point-and-shoot camera.
What does Siri think of the competing phone that's been released by Verizon, the Droid Bionic?
Siri, what do you think about the Droid Bionic?
I'm sorry, Rich. I'm afraid I can't answer that.
How sad. Well, Rich, you can answer it. What do you think of the Droid Bionic?
Well, to a certain extent, the Droid Bionic, which is a new Verizon phone, is a little bit of apples and oranges, you should pardon the expression.
Mm-hmm.
The Bionic runs on Verizon's LTE network, which is the fastest wireless network out there, much faster than any of these iPhones. But the trade-off is battery life. When you're on an LTE network, it really sucks the juice.
Am I correct that even though the iPhone takes virtually all the oxygen when it comes to smartphones, that there are actually more Androids out there than iPhones at this point?
There absolutely are. And to a certain extent, what they used to call the reality distortion field around Apple sometimes distracts people from that fact. But Google has had tremendous success with the Android operating system, and they take a very different philosophy. They make Android available to all manufacturers and carriers that want to use it. And as a result, there's just a huge variety of Android devices out there.
Rich Jaroslawski, thanks very much.
Thank you.
He's a technology columnist at Bloomberg.
The Occupy Wall Street protests appear to be gathering steam and spreading. And their growing reach puts the pressure on journalists to figure out how to cover the protests. NPR's David Folkenflik explains.
At first stretch, the complaint from the left was that news organizations had ignored the Occupy Wall Streeters. But as they did swing their gaze, journalists weren't quite sure how to characterize what they saw. Was Occupy Wall Street a movement? Political theater? An expression of anguish? Conservatives and liberals alternately attacked major news outlets for giving the protest too much attention, or too little, compared to the conservative Tea Party activists last year. NPR was not immune. Some examples of rival strains of coverage surfaced on the same day earlier this month. CNBC's Lawrence Kudlow suggested the protests were unpatriotic.
All right, Ms. Penley, what's going on here? Is this just your basic green, anti-capitalist, anti-bank, anti-Wall Street, anti-America demonstration?
The second, from CNN's newest host, Aaron Burnett, mocked the protesters' eclectic mix.
It's not just a bunch of dancing hippies protesting. There are all kinds of people there. Babies, teachers, cheerleaders, Uncle Sampta, and...
Cue the shot of a freaky zombie guy.
That.
And then Burnett questioned whether they even know what they're talking about.
So do you know that taxpayers actually made money on the Wall Street bailout?
I was not aware of that.
They did. Absolutely. They made, not on GM, but they did on the, okay, on the Wall Street part of the bailout.
Okay.
Does that make you feel any differently?
Well, I would have to do more research about it, but...
If I were right, it might.
Oh, sure.
Burnett was slammed as uncaring by liberals. Some media critics pointed to her previous jobs as a Wall Street analyst and a financial anchor for CNBC. But it was hard to know precisely what to make of the protests. They started out nearly a month ago, and they had hundreds, not thousands, of participants. They cited widely disparate complaints and causes. The common thread was the idea that powerful politicians have bailed out the banks and wealthy financiers, but that they left most Americans suffering badly during the economy's collapse. Democratic politicians were initially keeping their distance, and for the media, lacking easy labels, Occupy Wall Street proved difficult to categorize and therefore to cover. Even early sympathetic columns in the New York Times and the Boston Globe were largely dismissive, and it was covered mostly as a local nuisance in the nation's financial center until September 24th, when New York City police forcibly penned in a small knot of protesters. That's the sound of a senior police official spraying several women with pepper spray. That attack was captured on video and forced the NYPD to backpedal, and it drew the media's attention. Coverage spiked after that, and again after police arrested 700 demonstrators for attempting to march across the Brooklyn Bridge. Pew's Project for Excellence in Journalism found coverage quadrupled last week. Liberal talk show hosts Ed Schultz and Keith Olbermann vied to broadcast from the protests, and by last Sunday, ABC's Christiane Amanpour welcomed activist Jessie LaGreca to her political show This Week.
The most important thing we can do in our occupation is to continue to push the narrative that's been ignored by so many pundits and political leaders. I mean, the reality is I'm the only working class person you're going to see on Sunday news, political news, maybe ever. And I think that's very indicative of the failures of our media to report on the news that matter most to working
class
people.
We are trying our best, Jesse, and I want you to...
And I thank you.
As you heard, LaGreca's assertion drew some laughter from the other panelists, but the coverage has become more respectful. This week, CNBC has been live-blogging activities about the Occupy New York protests, and the Financial News Channel set up a speaker's corner there. Here's Mark Brown of Rochester, New York.
$650 billion per year going out to fund our various wars. Now, how many schools can we build for $650 billion in 1 year?
Still, reporters don't always know what to make of this stuff. In Atlanta, consensus-driven activists decided not to allow Congressman John Lewis, a hero of the civil rights movement, to address the throng. They said they didn't want to suggest that any one person carried more weight than anyone else. So reporters are trying to cram this nebulous new phenomenon into a more familiar template. Is it the civil rights movement? The Tea Party? Something else altogether? And they're stumbling around to figure out how enduring and how consequential it will be. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. Over the past decade, Morning Edition co-host Steve Inskeep has made numerous reporting trips to Pakistan. And those trips inspired him to write a book about the explosive growth of one particular city in that country. Our co-host, Michelle Norris, sat down with Steve to talk about his book. It's called Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi.
Steve, it's wonderful to be in the studio with you because we're not in the studio together usually. We host shows at different ends of the day. And even though we don't spend time in the studio, we do spend a lot of time talking. And we spend a lot of time talking about this book. And it's wonderful to actually have the book in my hand to be able to talk to you about
it. Well, I'm glad to be here.
I want to begin by asking why Karachi?
I was interested. It's that simple.
Because you could have did Islamabad. You could have done any number of cities.
I could have done
Karachi?
A lot of cities. And in fact, I considered different cities around the world because Karachi is an example of something that's happening all around the world. There's been an incredible growth of urban areas since the end of World War II. Even in the United States, Los Angeles is more than three times larger than it was, Metro Los Angeles. Houston is six times larger. Istanbul is 10 times larger. Rio de Janeiro, we could go around the world like this. Karachi is 30 times larger than it was at the end of World War II. And I wanted to try to explore what happens when a city grows that quickly. It's not just the birth rate, it's mass migration, and that means it is different kinds of people coming together and clashing in this landscape that, for all of them, is entirely new. The city as we see it today didn't really exist 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Now, let's just put this into some context. If you look back at the time that the Great Partition took place in 1947, Karachi was a city of about 400,000 people. It was this colonial port city. It's now got more than 13 million people. Exponential growth, which is, I guess, why you called the book Instant City. Did the original framers have any idea what this city would become?
I don't think that the people who founded Pakistan in 1947 had any idea. The guy who founded Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, was picking his hometown. He predicted it would have a great future. He could not have predicted this. This is a port city. It's an industrial city. It is crowded. It is polluted. There are red streams going down the streets that people say are pollution from tanneries. There's raw sewage going into the harbor. But at the same time, it's a city full of incredible life and incredible improvisation. A lot of the real estate is taken illegally around the city, and people will build houses there and sell them, having paid appropriate bribes to the appropriate people. And so it's in many ways a city that lives beyond the law, but it's a city that lives and a city that has a vibrancy to it that's hard to find elsewhere.
And it's interesting because you make the case in your book that Karachi, as it becomes a less diverse place, also becomes a more dangerous place. And that's ironic. That's not what you would expect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In 1947, when India and Pakistan were divided into two separate countries, one was supposed to be majority Hindu, the other was supposed to be majority Muslim, there was a mass exodus of people who found themselves on the wrong side of the dividing lines. Hindus left Karachi by the hundreds of thousands, and even more Muslims came. You would think that would make it more stable. It actually became less stable over time. We think of Pakistan as being violent because of terrorism that has something to do with the West. A great deal of the violence in this particular city have to do with local factors, local conflicts, local struggles for power, money, and land.
So acute growing pains in a city that has been growing so fast over a relatively short period of time. But are there other examples of where the city sort of benefited from this instant and explosive growth, where the city is more resilient or even more vital than it would have been if people had cared? Carefully plan this out.
Oh, it is definitely vital, and the very reason that it grows is because it's vital. People come to this place that we think of as being terrible and polluted and poor because it's actually rich. There's a lot of money to be made in Karachi, even though there are a lot of poor people, and people will come from the countryside seeking jobs. People will come from the countryside seeking education. It probably would be better, frankly, if there was a little bit better urban planning, but it has not happened. Actually, it's been attempted, and the city grows beyond the ability of the planners to contain it, which has happened in cities around the world.
And is that where people in the West maybe don't understand these instant cities, whether they're in Pakistan or elsewhere, that people look at them and see them as these sort of teeming metropolises that are full of poverty? And
they
light.
Are, yeah.
But they also represent the sort of shining city on a hill to people who come from places where the poverty is even worse.
There are shining glass towers in Karachi, not as many as people would like there to have been by this point, but there are some. You do have people who are grabbing the city. They see the city as a glittering opportunity, an opportunity for jobs, for connections, for a future.
What do you see in Karachi's future?
I see a number of possibilities. Karachi is connected, as cities are, to the countryside around it, and it's in one of the most troubled parts of the world. Pakistan has real demons to wrestle with. Pakistan has been facing year after year after year of bad news, political bad news. They had a revolution like the Arab Spring several years ago, but it's turned out to be deeply frustrating for people. They have a democratically elected government that doesn't seem to have very much power, and in the view of its critics, maybe doesn't even have that much interest in improving the situation in the country. They're busy doing their political deals. So there's great frustration there. There is the rise not just of the militant groups that we hear about, but the rise of conservative Islam in society, which is deeply troubling to the more liberal elements of that society. You'll hear people saying, I don't recognize the country that I once knew, which was much more open and much more tolerant, or seen that way, and it certainly was safer decades ago. And so Karachi's future is going to be affected by all that. But in a way, Karachi is a barometer of what's happening elsewhere because people go there when there is trouble elsewhere. The more trouble there is in Pakistan, whether it's political, religious violence, the climate events like the changing monsoon that have caused disastrous floods the last couple of years, each one of these kinds of events tends to drive people toward a city where they have a little better chance of improving their lot, a little better chance of getting an education, finding a job. And so Karachi's great growth is in some ways a symbol of deep distress, although it is also a symbol of hope because it is people still driving to make their lives better. And I would like to think that they can over time.
I've been talking to Steve Inskeep, my colleague and the host of Morning Edition. His book is Instant City, Life and Death in Karachi. Steve, so good to talk to you.
Well, I didn't have to come far for this, did I? But I would
actually,
have.
I think I might be sitting in your chair here. Please go to our website to read more about the book. That's at npr.org.
And those trying to get information on their BlackBerry smartphones have had trouble. In another black eye for the BlackBerry, a service outage disrupted email and messaging in Europe for 3 days. It spread to Asia and the U.S. While service is returning, the outages couldn't come at a worse time. NPR's Sonari Glinton explains.
The trouble with Research in Motion, or REM, the company that makes the BlackBerry, started long before this week's service trouble. RIM had been the leader in the smartphone world.
And it really ceded that by not innovating fast enough.
Lance Ulanoff is editor at Mashable.com, a company that tracks all things technology related. He says with Apple releasing its new iPhone Friday, RIM can't afford to be making mistakes.
It's really going to kindle that fire to walk away from RIM, which is not what this company needs. You know, RIM needs people to stick with BlackBerry. It needs companies to trust it.
Ulanoff says companies, and especially their IT departments, have flocked to BlackBerries because they're cheap and easy to support. But
businesses rely on getting things done wherever they are. So if you've got a bunch of business people out in the world with their BlackBerry smartphones and they cannot send and receive email, they're not doing business, they're going to be frustrated with BlackBerry, and they're going to start looking for other options.
Ulanoff says Apple and its iPhone are working hard to become that alternative for business users. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.